Hello and welcome to episode 168 of What Most People Think. And listen, I did an episode of this show last Thursday, and so much has happened in the meantime. I mean, I just felt like I could have done a podcast every fucking day. What is going on? Well, that's the job. That's the job of this podcast. It's called What Most People Think, and it is, you know, trying to get to the heart of ordinary political views. And, you know, there was a time when this podcast was, you know, sort of defending the Conservative government and going after Labour. Well, you know, I would be a liar if I didn't have lots of criticisms about what's going on at the heart of government now, whilst also still shining the light on the opposition, asking what the fuck they would do. And if you talk about the mood of the country, I did a Times radio event on Saturday. I mean, this was a funny thing, was I thought it was just me, Hugo Rifkin and Jess Phillips just talking in a studio. So I had no idea why I was in Cheltenham. I thought there might be a small audience. I got there, it was 600 people. And I've got to say, you know, I get on all right with Jess. She's one of those Labour people who doesn't hate Tories. And I think in the age of Nicola Sturgeon detesting the Tories, where's Monster? I think we need more of that. I think that's important for Labour, is, you know, when they're trying to win back Tories, is to not fucking demonise people that have voted for them before. And there was 600 people at this recording, and I'll say they looked like, I mean, if you literally had, like, what does a Tory voter look like? You go, well, maybe over the age of 65, silver hair, up and about early on a Saturday. You know those people? You know when you see them at 10 a.m. and they're going, oh, just having some lunch. You know that kind of person that's so up and at it. I was up at 6 a.m. listening to Radio 4. And they were not happy with the government. So I don't know if you can base polls on how the people of Cheltenham feel. But it's not looking good at the moment with the Conservatives. I mean, and I will be speaking about, it's a guest episode this week, but I will be speaking about the politics shortly. But just as a sort of idea of which way the wind is blowing, you know, I mean, we had that, and I will be speaking about politics shortly before we go on to what is a guest episode with the brilliant Richard Herring, which I'll explain a bit more about in the moment. But it was quite something seeing Liz Truss turn up in Parliament when Penny Mordaunt was answering questions on her behalf, and then Jeremy Hunt stood up and was like, you just sit there, dear. Daddy will handle this one. And Liz Truss just sat there staring ahead like she'd done a massive line of ketamine. I mean, it was something else, man. And then later that day on ITN, Liz Truss gave an interview, I think, or was it on ITN or BBC, to Chris Mason, maybe? And I love ordinary people who give you an idea of which way the wind's blowing. And my wife just looked at her and went, God bless her, she still thinks she's Prime Minister. So we will be speaking about the a torrid last 7 days politically. As I mentioned earlier, Richard Herring is on the show, and he's got a book out very shortly on the 20th of October called Can I Have My Ball Back? Which is a brilliant title that alludes to the fact that he went through bollock cancer. But we will speak about that. We will speak about, you know, issues in and around, you know, the male testicles. Is there any other kind of testicles? I mean, I go and say that, but there'd probably be someone who would say, you know, women can have testicles. But there's so much more than that, because Richard's book has a jumping off point for a lot of different things, including, you know, podcasting, his life in comedy, you know, men's mental health, how we approach these things. So that will be coming up for the bulk of the show. But the main talking point for this week is, I mentioned in last week's show, which do please check out. It went up a bit later than usual, but do check that out. It's got a lot of tales of my time in Las Vegas. I don't know how the political stuff will have aged. I suspect, given the last 7 days, it'll have aged like fine fucking yogurt. But I mentioned Andrew Jackson as being a president of, I thought he was the first president of the USA. He was the seventh. Is it really obvious who the first one was? Was it George Washington? But Andrew Jackson served from 1829 to 1837. I mean, God, in the current era, that's a good knock. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, at the moment, the amount of time that prime ministers are serving for, it's like when there's a really difficult cricket tour and no one's hit 100, and then someone hits like a swift 47 and they get a standing ovation. So that would be a great knock in the current context. I was moaning about airlines and the fact that none of them ever seem to take off online. And David has informed me that the number of British and Irish airlines in 2021, in terms of flights departing on time, Aer Lingus there, 98.3% for Aer Lingus. I would say if you're listening from Aer Lingus and you're in marketing, just say that. You know all those fucking airlines that just treat the departure time like some sort of nominal, aspirational thing to work towards, but never necessarily achieve? Well, at Aer Lingus, we take off on time, followed by Blue Islands. I don't know what Blue Islands is, at 95.2%. That just sounds, you know, one of those airlines that came up in the deregulation era that was just called like, yeah, Fly Air, that just had a really shit name of like Whoosh Airline. You know, those ones where the names are like so amateurish, they actually make you wonder, you think, are they going to fucking crash? Who's running this thing? Is it like some 18-year-old kid who inherited some money from his gran? And the worst was Virgin Airlines at 85.3%. Based on those numbers, I mean, I think that their idea of taking off on time isn't the same as mine, right? I think that probably means took off within an hour of when they said they might take off. So let's do the new patrons. Nicholas Tull, Mr. Tull. I don't know if you remember last week, his wife gave him the gift of being a patron. Well, somebody has upgraded that to the board. Welcome to the board. And James Walker. So Mr. Tull and Mr. Walker. I mean, these sound like absolute fucking titans of the boardroom here. They're coming in. Maybe they're coming in with new ideas. You know, maybe the rest of the board members, maybe what they're going to do, a coup. Is there going to be a boardroom coup here? Karen, please immediately bring tea. We don't want coffee today, Karen. We want tea. All right, let's calm these fuckers down. Just a reminder for the board level is that if you edit your pledge up to £20 or above, there is a special welcome gift. Now, this will have been communicated directly to the board members, and for our new board members, I will give a reminder of this too soon. I think it's worth the money on it itself, but like all things in and around the board, what happens in the board stays in the board. So you've got to become a board member to find out what's going on there. And there is, of course, the for all the patrons, there's the benefit of the Jeff Norcott and Friends gigs. I'm not sure I can carry off the Jeff Norcott and Friends thing. I think you've got to be a bit more well known for that. Do you know what I mean? You've got to be like a Joe Lycett or Romesh Ranganathan, but I don't know what to call it. Maybe that bloke Jeff Norcott and Friends, or that geezer off the politics shows, or that Tory comic and Friends, I don't know. So speaking of politics, we're just going to track back a little bit here. We'll track back. I mean, things have moved so much between the last... Remember the last podcast, Kwasi Kwarteng was Chancellor and Liz Truss was Prime Minister. I mean, I know she's still technically Prime Minister, but oh, bless her. She still thinks she's Prime Minister. But Kwasi, he went over to the IMF to... God, as you say this, it just sounds worse. He went over to the IMF to reassure everybody about their plan for growth. And he said he was 100% certain. 100%! 100% was incredible. 100% certain he'd still be the Chancellor. And then he got fired, stepping off a plane, coming back to the UK. I mean, the worst thing I found out getting off a plane is that my luggage had gone to Vietnam. Not that I'd lost my job. And trust then, you know, afterwards, her authority is immediately gone. Because, of course, she's told him to do this. And then she's fired him. They've agreed on this together. And then she's fired him for doing the thing that she agreed on. And as someone a lot funnier than me said on Twitter, maybe they should get the unions involved. Maybe Kwasi should give Mick Lynch a shout, because that's good, feels like one for the unions. And then she does this briefing, which is to I can't even remember what day this was, but to row back on the corporation tax thing. And what I thought was interesting about all this was that there was no real negotiation, right? So the corporation tax is 19%. So it's a planned rise. This isn't a tax cut. It was a planned rise under Rishi Sunak to 25%, which is a fucking massive hike, right? But it's going to be 19%. And I thought, where's the negotiation? You know, if we're negotiating with the markets, which is seemingly now run everything, it's like you go into a used car salesman, right? And they go, how much is that car there? They go, 25 grand. They go, that feels a lot more than they're currently worth. I'll pay 19. They go, 25. You go, 19. They go, 25. And you go, all right, I'll pay 25. And then it'll be one of those ones where even the car salesman's going, you could have put in a cheeky 21 and a half. But yeah, absolutely. And then she gives this briefing where she just announces it in a fairly automaton way. And then straight afterwards. Now, I'm generally against these tightly clipped videos of politicians or people doing stuff where they're held up as an example of exactly who they are. But there is this clip of Liz Truss when she was behind the lectern. There's about 4 seconds where she's just looking around. And sometimes you just see what a person is and maybe what they're capable of. And she looked completely out of her depth. And you know why I know that? It's because she was doing what I would have done at that point. That's why I'm not Prime Minister. She was looking around going, fucking hell. And I cannot believe that she was only slated to answer 4 questions from the press. I think what happened, just on a human instinct level, is that it overwhelmed her a bit and she bolted earlier than she should have. So in terms of reassuring people, it kind of It kind of performed the opposite. Maybe she just said, hey, you said briefing. I kept it brief. And then suddenly in comes Jeremy Hunt, right? Yeah, Jeremy Hunt is now the new Chancellor, who finished 8th out of 8 in the Tory leadership race. Lost to Boris a few years previously. But maybe Jeremy Hunt is the ultimate example of fake it till you make it, all right? He's like the guy in X Factor. Do you remember the person that got like sent home at fucking boot camp and then, I don't know, when they get to the X Factor live finals, it turns out one of the finalists microwaves a fucking hamster on TikTok. And so they've got to get someone in. And he goes, why have they got that guy? Oh, okay, Jeremy Hunt in the live finals. And as I said, you know, he does all this stuff to reassure the markets. And you go, is it all to reassure the markets? Is some of this a degree of political manoeuvring here? This does feel like a one-man defenestration. You know, sit there, love, sit there. You know, daddy's back. Reassure the markets. And in a further attempt to reassure the markets, I will manacle Liz Truss and parade her around College Green chanting, shame, shame, shame. You know, I mean, he rode back on so much. He rode back on so much that it wasn't even like the plans from the mini budget. He went back on Rishi Sunak's pledge to reduce income tax by 2024. I mean, where does it stop? It's like we've also rode back on the idea of Liz Truss being called Liz. She's now called Lucy. Isn't that right, Lucy? Say it. Look at me. Say it. Say my name is Lucy. Oh, my God. Do you know what she's like? She's like, I don't know if anybody's seen Game of Thrones, but you know that series where that guy, I can't remember his name, but he becomes Reek. I mean, that's such a brutal analogy. Even I feel a bit uncomfortable about saying it. But look, if you know the show, you know what I mean. And then the markets, you know, Joe Biden's chipping in. The markets are chipping in. I think we are moving to a very technocratic age here where, hey, maybe this is weird. We're just getting back to democracy as it should be, right? Which is that Britain is run by a combination of markets, Joe Biden, and Tory MPs who text Emily Maitlis late at night. Is any part of you think it's weird with all the Tory MPs texting Emily Maitlis? Fucking weirdos. Anyway, in fairness to Hunt, he can actually speak to people. So whatever it is, the path that the government is now plotting, he can communicate it. He can stand up and he can say words, right? And the same is true of Penny Mordaunt, who stood up in the Commons and took the urgent question from the opposition, from Keir Starmer. I mean, it really wasn't a question, was it? I mean, it wasn't an urgent question. It was mainly like, what the fuck is going on? Which I think probably resonates with a lot of the country at the moment. I mean, seriously, what the fuck? And then this is a weird moment where, while Penny Mordaunt is fielding a question on the PM's behalf, Liz Truss bowls in, sits down next to Jeremy Hunt. He basically stands up and says, does his sort of patriarchal thing. And then she bowls out again. And there was this weird thing that Penny Mordaunt... First of all, I think Penny Mordaunt did well. Same with Jeremy Hunt. They can do politics, all right? There is a value to this, being able to stand up and communicate ideas. And Penny Mordaunt, I'm going to say again, I think she's hot. And I'm only saying this, you might think, oh, it's toxic, you shouldn't talk about female politicians in that way. Well, we've had the Millie fandom, we've had people crushing on Keir Starmer and stuff. I'm fighting back one for the lads. I'm crushing on Mordaunt, all right? I'm crushing on Penny. I mean, mainly on the hair, let's be honest, and I'm sure the ladies are with me on this, but that, whatever you feel about politics, as a woman, you have to look at Penny Mordaunt's hair and go, fair play, that has got some body to it. and you know, what's happened here is so beyond anything I've ever experienced in politics. It's not just like a... It's not as if they've just gone back a bit, a U-turn. This is like a movie franchise. You know when they try and reset it? You know, like J.J. Abrams did with Star Trek, where he sort of said, you know the characters they were originally, we're going to go back before that, we're going to restart that whole fucking story. You know what it is, maybe for older people, it's like Bobby Ewing's waking up in the shower. I'd like to offer a bit of balance here and say that Labour attack lines are, even given like the utter state the government in, like it never fails to surprise me how poor Labour's attack lines are. Rachel Reeves was very good in the Commons. You know, she had some good jokes. Starmer had a couple of good jokes. But as I've seen like Labour ministers out and about doing the rounds, I'd think they'd do well to just avoid speaking, because what there is a reminder of is that the Tories are in turmoil, but Labour are still an empty space in terms of policy. I mean, I don't really know how they transition from this thing where they're going, oh, you've spooked the markets, you've done a lot of borrowing, you've raised highest tax burden, to in 2 years going, okay, so we're going to borrow some money and we're going to spook the markets and we're going to raise taxes. At some point, that is a transition the Labour Party have to make. Either that, or they're not going to govern as a very left-wing option. I do think, you know, for a while we've been speaking about whether or not Starmer is, you know, is he Kinnock? Is he Blair? Is he Miliband? He's fucking Nick Clegg. is what he's going to be, because he's going to come into office at a time when there's very little money, and he's just going to have to... There'll be a degree of, I think, you know, if and when, and it seems more likely when, Labour win, there'll be a degree of continuity, right? Either that, or we accept that sometimes, to do what a government needs to do for a country, the markets might have to be a little bit spooked. You know, and like, when it comes to the Tories, I think what most people think, I mean, let's be honest, right? Whenever the next election was, it was always going to be a lot for the Conservatives after 14 years of power to win another election. And maybe people just think, you know, it's time for another option. I still, I'm not alarmed by the idea of a Labour government to the same degree that I was under Corbyn. I am alarmed by the idea of them having a fucking 500 seat majority and there being only 20 Tory MPs. I don't think that's going to happen. I think, you know, the closer it gets, once people start seeing that election map where the dominant colour is red, it's either Labour or the SNP running the whole of the United Kingdom. Yeah, not so much, not for me. So I don't think we're looking at, but it could be on the scale of perhaps 97. I just think maybe it's very simple, is that being in charge throughout Brexit and COVID has just sort of fried the Conservative circuitry, isn't it? They've just kind of burnt through talent. A lot of people on the front bench, new person comes in, they want their own power base. Like I always said, Boris's big mistake was getting rid of some seriously good political operators. Then you have like inexperienced people in. Those people don't do a job, you burn through them, you have to bring back some of the old people, and that always looks like you're going backwards. And bit by bit, they've just burnt through a lot of talent. And here we have a version of the Conservative Party, which is neither really got an obvious plan for growth and nor a plan for raising taxes. So what, you know, the Jeremy Hunt version of the Conservatives is basically gluten-free. Okay, we're going to chat with Richard Herring now. So just to kind of like hit the ground running, Richard's book, Can I Have My Ball Back, is about his experiences over the last year or so whereby he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. He had one of his bollocks removed and then he had certain kind of like scares after that. But obviously it's a very funny book, which I've read and thoroughly enjoyed, and it's out on the 20th of October. And he was good enough to join me for a chat. And I think the great thing about this is like, I don't know, you know, some of you might put Richard in the thing with like, you know, lefty comic, but you know, when it comes to how he views politics and how he wants to talk about it and his views on cancel culture as well, I think, you know, do enjoy this interview because I think he's got a lot of opinions that might come from an angle that you wouldn't expect. So let's have a really deep chat about bollocks and plenty more besides with Richard Herring. So I'm delighted to welcome to What Most People Think is Richard Herring. Welcome to the show.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
Well, yeah, it's very exciting. I think it's on the 20th of October that your book comes out.
Yeah.
And a brilliant title, Can I Have My Ball Back?
Yeah.
I mean, when you think, well, you know, testicular cancer, bollocks, how much, because there's so many great puns in this book, how much fun did you have just trying to explore every single gag avenue around balls, basically?
It's just one of those things, you know, like, you know, if you're going to get cancer and you're a comedian, this is the best place you can get cancer, because obviously there's, you know, it's the funniest place to get cancer, so there's more jokes. People, for some reason, with this, you know, most cancer people take quite seriously, but you get so many tweets and stuff and so many yeah. People basically offering, you know, when I was writing a book, so many people offered titles, and this one didn't come up, although subsequently someone's got in touch to say they've written a book about testicular cancer with almost the same title, but this one didn't come up at all. So like, yeah, there's a part of you thinking, well, I want to try and come up with better ones than other people can come up with, but it's, you know, I think you've sort of got to do it because people will do it themselves if you don't do it. So I nearly went for, my first thing was Never Mind My Bollock, which I think is probably a bit of an obvious one, which a few people suggested, or something around Never Mind the Bollocks. Yeah. And my publishers really liked that one. And then I came up with this one and I actually tried them out in a podcast and this got a huge laugh, and Never Mind My Bollock didn't really get anything. So I went back to the publisher and said, I've road tested it and it's got to be Can I Have My Ball Back? And they I think they preferred the other one. And they come on, oh yeah, yeah, I think that is good. And it's one of the, I think it's a, you know, it's a good title because people laugh at it straight away. So it's a great start to get, you know that with an Edinburgh show, if you've got an Edinburgh title that yes. people are, and a poster that people are laughing at, you go, that's pretty good. They're laughing before they've even started. So
I mean, yeah. Obviously, you know, when like I've written one book, you've written several books. How much? I bet there was a point where you were sitting down, and you was thinking about the narrative arc of it and how you tell the story. But I wonder how disproportionate the time was that you spent of thinking of bollock puns.
it was weird. I found writing books really hard generally. And this one, just like my bollock, just came out of me almost not quite in one go, but like I, you know, I would.
It's not as big in some ways. It's
luckily, it nearly got as big as this book. But you know, I think it was just, I think it was such a cathartic thing to. It was quite hard to write the book in terms of, I think reliving it was suddenly. The trauma of it started hitting me a bit more than it had at the time, really, because I'd sort of laughed my way through and got through it by distraction, but also thinking I'm going to fight, you know, I'm going to be positive about this, which I was. I did find it nearly all a positive experience. And so it was sort of weird writing the book. But yeah, I think a lot of those things, I wanted to try and have different. I'd written a book called Talking Cock previously, ironically. The fact that this happened to me, there's so many kind of parallels with previous shows. Like I did a show about Hitler moustache and now I've got Hitler's balls and all that sort of Hitler's balls.
Yeah.
And so there's so many kind of things that link back to stuff I did before. But with Talking Cock, I had a lot of fun of trying to come up with a different euphemism for penis pretty much every time I wrote it. So I think I was sort of a bit schooled in doing that. So I wanted to try and do the same for balls. It's a bit harder with balls. There isn't quite as many ways you can
Of the two, do you have any favourites that you remember, like any euphemisms that you've sort of stuck with you?
I liked comparing them to a sort of slightly less wrinkly version of the Chuckle Brothers, especially given that, you know, arguably the most popular one is now gone as well. And I think like things like kiwi fruits in a sort of shopping bag, I think is in a hairy shopping bag. It's sort of quite, it's nice when you get into that almost poetic, but I love Viz and I always love Viz Profanosaurus. And I love how poetic they are with coming up with, in fact, in Talking Cock, I got one of my things in talk. I called an erection a naughty Nazi salute, and that got into the Viz Profanosaurus, which is probably one of my greatest achievements.
So the angle of an erect penis, the naughty Nazi salute,
the naughty Nazi. If you're younger, now it's I don't know what you call it. Now, 55.
Yeah, the cautious Nazi salute. You know, some of the moderates in the party that were like, well, some of this might be on film in a few years. I don't want to seem too keen. It was interesting what you said about, you know, it being ripe for comedy. You make this great example about, you know, that you can joke about this. And I think you said it'd be very different if you were writing jokes about liver cancer. And you know, that's one of the great things about comics when they turn to write, is you knew to find the thing that just sounded the most unfunny. Because, like, if you'd have gone, like, AIDS, right, everyone goes, well, we know for some weird fucking reason AIDS is sort of like a go-to gag in some respects. But liver cancer, you go, oh, that is really... really serious.
Yeah. I think partly because I know a couple of people who've had liver cancer and died from it. And so I think, you know, I think that really, as a comedian, we would find our way through that. You know, I would still write a book if I had a worse cancer, which hopefully I won't, but if I get one and was going to write about it, I would still want to be funny about it. But obviously it's much harder. It's much harder to find what's funny. But none of this is, of course, laughing at the idea of having cancer. But it's the idea of laughing, you know, using laughter as a way to cope with it. I think, as with anything, you know, anything that's horrific or unpleasant, if we're able to laugh at it, even if it's going to defeat us ultimately, it gives us a little bit of power over something that we're, you know, with cancer, you're fairly powerless. And like, you know, people can talk about battles with cancer and surviving cancer, but, you know, I did nothing in this but lie back and let medical professionals sort it out. You know, none of it was my choice. So, you know, you're a passive part in nearly all of this, I think. So it's, I this as well. And I think it's just not for everyone. And obviously if you want to take cancer very seriously, don't go to a comedy show about it or read a book about it. Yeah. But I think it was really interesting how just talking about it on Twitter, me and my wife had a big discussion about whether I was going to, you know, mention it in social media and my blogs and stuff, and whether that, you know, my wife's going, Steve Bennett from Chortle will get hold of it and it'll be all over Chortle and you want that and all that. Although he never wrote about it at all.
Oh, well, that's a classic thing with a comic. You sort of think it would be awful if he did. And then when he doesn't, you're going, oh, well, that's a bit, you know.
Yeah, why didn't he do that?
Yeah.
But actually by writing about it and being open about it and, you know, I got so many positive responses on social media and, you know, incredibly... I think at the moment the book hasn't even come out yet. I think it's three or four people have said it was a result of me mentioning it, they've gone and got checked out and found out they have testicular cancer. And obviously many more have gone to find out they haven't got testicular cancer. But that's sort of amazing that you know, by talking about it. It was helpful to me because turns out testicular cancer is a very curable cancer to have. And people who'd had it 30 years ago were tweeting me going, don't worry, you'll almost certainly be fine.
But and that is a good reason to go and get checked, you know. But I can sit here and do that. It always feels good, doesn't it, as a comic when you have a little message and you go, look, guys, do go and get checked. I know for a fact I haven't checked myself ever. Right. And I also know for a fact, even subsequent to saying this now, I probably still won't check myself. I don't know what it is. What is it? Because you're in that sort of category as well. You were honest enough to say that you'd done that exact thing. Why won't we roll our balls around enough? Because you think about how much time we spend playing with our knob, touching it, looking at it. But when it comes to doing something that might save our life, we're like, oh, fuck it, I'm not getting involved with that. Do you know what I mean?
It's a weird thing, and it's a weird thing about masculinity. I think and it's not exclusive to men, and not all men, Jeff, it's not all men. But, you know, so I think the fear of finding, you know, it's so stupid. It's so dumb, because I think it's about the fear of you'd rather not know, because... You know, so I think that's the only point, you know, and but I'm still the same. I had like a little extra problem with the remaining one. I had a little, I thought there was a lump on it, and I thought, oh, fuck, I'm a goner, you know, this is terrible, it's going to spread. And even after having that, I now find it almost traumatic. It was turned out to be nothing, it was just a cyst.
Yeah.
But having had that, I find it quite traumatic to go, because you just start imagining, especially once you've had something go wrong, you start imagining, oh, is that bigger? Has it changed? Mm. But yeah, I mean, even if you're just, you know, even when you're fiddling around with yourself, if you just try and get an awareness of, you know, size and it's so crazy not to do it, Jeff. And, you know, just if you're in the bath and you're washing it, just have a little check to see. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're sensitive, aren't they? I think there's a part of you thinks, do I want to be going around? You know,
yeah, well, so I sort of think of it as like, you know, when someone touches your eye.
Yeah.
But then again, I've always thought when I've watched porn, one of the things that really stands out is what an absolute battering the balls get. You know, I mean, if you watch it for as long, you go, look at them, absolute soldiers. And it is incredible. There are a couple of situations where I don't understand why they don't experience. But it's like they know that they're at the sharp end of what they're there to do.
Yeah.
And they switch off the pain receptors. So I guess we need to be a little bit sensitive, a little bit less sensitive about that. I mean, one of the things that's interesting as well in the book is you also have a lot of facts. And at the end of each chapter, you know, you explore some of the sort of nomenclature of bollocks and the glossary of balls. Testicular transplants are possible.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you were to have one, you would keep reproducing the sperm of the person that didn't have them, or probably the dead person in that respect.
Yeah.
And unsurprisingly, they're not that popular, testicular transplants.
It's morally too questionable. So there's things on the internet people claim to be buying testicles for $80,000 or something, but I think that's apocryphal. It's a complicated you know, surgery to do it, obviously, to reattach it. But the moral question of, if you'd said, Rich, I'm really sorry you've lost a ball, I want you to have one of mine, I respect you so much. The moral problem of me then, I mean, it is so amazing that it carries on creating your sperm once it's out of you. I mean, I can't get my head around, there's nothing, you know, only your brain and maybe your ovaries, if you're a woman, would do anything like that, you know, that would still be, you would feel, if you put your heart in someone else, it would become their heart, if it was a match, you know. But if you put your balls in someone else, it's still creating your sperm. So obviously, if I gave you one of my balls, or you gave me one of your balls, and I ended up having a kid, and then who's the dad of the kid? You know, the DNA result says it's your kid. So it's only happened about 3 times, and it's between like twins who have the same DNA anyway, I think, basically, don't they? And so it's and that's sort of acceptable. But yeah, but you know, as a straight man, you might think, do I want Jeff Norcott spunk on my tummy every time I have a wank? And, you know.
You know, just learning about the testicles, one of the interesting things, and I became aware of this a few years ago, is obviously when women are born, women have all the eggs in them that they're going to have for their whole life when they're born. Yeah. But testicles are the thing that changes, you know. So it feels unlikely, but men are where evolution happens, right?
I guess partly, yeah. But, you know, but I was, I suppose.
Hey, ladies, you know, when you see that.
I suppose also with, you know, the eggs may be there, but they can evolve. Things change and evolve. But yeah, I mean, it's
Is that why we're so sort of frenetic and women, you just, is that where serenity comes from in women? It's all that. I'm not saying that women aren't prone to sort of like their own kind of toxic behaviours, but blokes, as you rightly say, we're carrying around a lot of responsibility. Not only on any given day could we repopulate a continent, we're also sort of pushing the whole sort of like natural selection thing forward. It's a lot to take on, isn't it, really?
It is a lot to take on, and it's an incredible, you know, I like I say in the book, if there was only one huge testicle and it was in space and it was spewing out life like this, it'd be worshipped as a god, because it's absolutely insane. The rate of sperm production is, you know, and the number of people that you could potentially create as a result is absolutely terrifying. And yet, because they're there, you know, even if you're just in the room on your own, there's still two of them for most people, most men, rather. But it's an amazing thing. It was really interesting looking at the science of it and why they're one hangs lower than the other. And, you know, it's a little bit about temperature and stuff, but there's kind of more to it than that. They can slightly retract. It's, you know, why they're outside the body when that seems like a, you know, that doesn't seem like a great way to operate, and they aren't outside the body in all species that have them. So it is possible. Yeah. It's not just about temperature. It's possible for them to be inside, but the fact they're outside seems like the worst design fault that they're, you know, if
it's asking for trouble, isn't it?
It is.
It's literally asking for trouble. Just hanging out there, waiting to be whacked. I mean, one of the things that you explore, which I've always enjoyed, is the inexplicable joy that people take at seeing another man whacked in the balls. I mean, I'm a big cricket fan, and it happens in cricket probably more than any sport. And I remember that Joe Root on the last tour down under, I mean, like it was so awful because he was captain, England were getting beat. I mean, it was a really terrible tour. It was during COVID. And he was getting repeatedly hit in the balls, repeatedly. And so, I mean, even now you're laughing. This is as a testicular cancer survivor, and it really got bad. Like in the end, like he had to. I mean, why am I laughing? He had to leave the pitch and go for like a scan and stuff. And like you're going, stop it. It's only adding to it. Is it because it's just like the most simple form of Schadenfreude type comedy? It's like that's the worst thing that could happen, and it's not happening to me.
Yeah, I think that basically, I think it is. I think there's an element of maybe, you know, because men are so, you know, identify as being so masculine or being tough, that to be so easily taken down is sort of, you know, as a comedic principle, I think that's pretty funny. I think for men, you know, but men still, women find it funny. You can say, well, that, you know, it's a little bit of revenge on men for being bastards or whatever they are. It's fun to see your partner in pain if they've annoyed you or someone else in pain. But the fact that men still find it funny, I think it is a knowledge that it's, you've been through it. So it's the comedy of understanding and of experience, but equally usually it's, you know, it's going to be fine as well. I mean, if someone, was whacked in the bollocks, you'd laugh initially, and then if you saw that one of the bollocks hanging off, or you know, or that you realised they were going to have to go to hospital, I think it would stop being funny then. It's just in that instant of, oh yeah, we've been there, look at him, he's down, he's in a lot of pain, but we know that within 3 or 4 minutes
it's the way that it evolves, isn't it? It's the fact that the pain isn't all there at the beginning. It's the fact that when it first happens and they're in a bit of pain, you go, this is actually going to get worse. This is going to get a bit worse before it gets better. I mean, it is one of those strange bodily injuries that that is disproportionate. I mean, one of the other ones that sort of ranks up there is in stubbing your toe. I've always thought that the toe is like this massive drama queen that just constant. Like if it was a person, it'd be somebody that was just creating shit, and then everyone goes around the house. It's absolutely, no, sorry, it's fine. I was just having a bit of a weird moment. But at least with the bollocks, you could go, well, maybe that is the screams of a million sperm. Maybe that's what the pain is.
But they're connected, you know, because they start in your stomach with, you know, before they descend. It's all connected. So the reason it hurts in your stomach is because your brain isn't able to tell where the pain's coming from, because it's also interconnected. So it's this incredibly sensitive area, obviously. And you know, we've all been through. I mean, in the book, I talk about the thing that possibly escalated this, my cancer happening, was like 20 years ago. I just got knocked over in the sea, having a terrible holiday with a girlfriend who was cheating on me, and we were about to break up. and I went into the sea and we were in Barbados. It was lovely, but I got kind of flipped over by this wave, hit my head, and my bollock like expanded out to like 4 or 5 times its size. And you kind of go, how's that? I've hit my head. What's happened to my bollock? And so I was on the plane and had as the plane went higher, the ball started hurting more. So every time we changed altitude, I could sense it in my ball. And yeah, even as that's happening to you, it was absolutely horrendous and terrifying as well. So I was on holiday, I didn't go to the doctor till I got home. I didn't know what the fuck was going on. But it is still, even that's funny. You know, the idea of a man.
Yeah, your bollock was a nervous flyer, essentially. I'm aware that there'll be some guys, right, because it is obviously a sensitive area, that are kind of like, they'll be starting to cross their legs a little bit. And the truth about the book is that there is so much more here, and it jumps off into other areas. I mean, you talk about, the podcast and how that got you through times. I mean, I've been listening to Rahul Estapa, for a long, long time. And it's been an interesting transition, because at the beginning, for a while, the joke was kind of like you're having on people that had the career that you wanted, right? And that was kind of funny. And then there was this period where you started getting on the younger millennial comics who started saying, no, we like your career. And you never took it fully seriously, and now it's undeniable that what you're doing is what a lot of comics kind of want to do. I mean, how was that? I mean, that must have been a positive thing to go through, to go, oh, actually, I was an early adopter, and this is really where it's at in comedy.
Yeah, it's been amazing, and it's just really luck. And I suppose, I was, the things that motivated me weren't maybe what motivates everyone. So, like, when I started doing podcasts in like 2008 or whenever it was very January 2008, I think it was. So many comedians go, why are you not getting paid? Why the hell are you doing this work and you're not getting paid? And nearly everyone said that. And I said, look, it's not about the money. It's about the freedom to do what I want. It's about, the immediacy of it. It's about experimentation. Let's see what we can do with this as an art form. And it's getting rid of the gatekeepers, which I was just so fed up of writing scripts or coming up with ideas that I knew were good. And then and everyone said they were good. And then one person at the top would go, no, I don't think that, have you tried doing this? And go, at that point, I've been writing comedy for 25 years or whatever. And someone who'd never written a script would tell me that my script wasn't any good, for whatever reason. And it'd be one.
I mean, that is something that's worth unpacking a little bit, is that sometimes you get notes, right, and ideas on things. I'm working with somebody at the moment, and they invariably provide good notes, and there's something that is quite reassuring about that. But then sometimes you'll get a note that's so much of a head fuck, it literally makes you want to do a different job. Like, where you go, they'll take something that's absolutely fundamental to, like, say you had a character that the starting point was that. Say, for example, he found out in the first day of lockdown that he had a child that he'd never met or something like that, right? Yeah. And that kind of fuels everything. And they're going, and then you get all the way through, you've written this for a year, and then someone goes, do we need to have that beginning? You go, you mean the thing that the whole fucking thing is predicated on? I mean, you must have had a few of those over the years.
Yeah, I mean, so that are loads. I mean, I've just written so many scripts that have fallen at various hurdles, but it's the last one that happened, the people were so stupid, and literally Noel Fielding was in it. We'd filmed a bit of it. The cast were going, this is one of the best scripts I've ever been involved in. It's such a good idea. The director, who's done loads of stuff, is going, yeah, look, there's so much in this. This is fantastic. And then I went for a meeting where the people just went, do we like, I don't really like the character, and and could you do it so that, because it was all about multiple universes and the fact that nothing matters because everything happens, and there's no, where's it going to go and what's the point? I go, well, the point is there's no point, but we'll, I would like to explore that as we go on. The meeting actually got, I said, I don't think you understand the script. And she got, the meeting got up and went out before it even finished. Everyone just stood up and left because that she was so annoyed that I'd said, I don't think you understand the idea, when she didn't understand the idea. And it just, so those things were so frustrating. And I just, I knew I had loads of stuff. And the thing, I do come up, I produce a lot of stuff, and podcasts allow me to, do stuff that I know will be a bit more commercial, but also to do stuff that I know 200 people are going to listen to and love, but everyone else will go, what the fuck is going on? So I love that freedom that you can say, if I said I'm going to do 10 years of playing myself at snooker and put that out as an audio only podcast for most of the time, if I took that to TV, they would rightly go, fuck off. But as a podcast, you can do it because there was so much at that time. It was all the Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross thing had just happened, and everyone was so cautious. And I wanted at that time to do comedy that was pushing back boundaries, and we were able to do comedy that pushed back boundaries in those ways at that time. That was sort of
Well, because that's the point. It's what people sometimes call edgy comedy. And I've heard many interviews where you've gone and followed lines of chat with guests that are, you know, really provocative and take risks. And I think you're right. People often forget that when they talk about censoriousness in comedy, they sort of forget that it's a moving entity. And sometimes it's about, you know, whether you can talk about, you know, what constitutes a biological sex or what constitutes a woman. But then sometimes it's just about taste and decency. And then right at the end of the noughties, I don't know if it's something to do with Labour having been in power for a while, but there did seem to be something very, you know, big C conservative about that Saxgate thing. You know, where is comedy going? It was in the era of Frankie Boyle talking about the Queen's pussy being haunted, and which, look, I mean, look, I'm a royalist. That is a funny sentence, you know, even now. And that's the point. Is so I've referenced that joke now, not long after what's happened with the Queen, but I'm going to leave it in the edit because it's my podcast, right? That's the point.
People choose to listen. So people download. If they don't like this, they stop. And that's sort of what comedy should be. If people don't like it, you don't buy a ticket. Comedy lives and dies. If you're not funny. You know, people will go to "you're not funny" to every comedian. And you go, if we're genuinely not funny, our job is assessed every single second of every single performance. And if we're not making people laugh, then we will not work it. We could do one gig where nobody laughed and the booker might go, "Oh, well, you know, bad luck, had a bad gig." Yeah. You know, if you did 10 gigs where nobody laughed, the booker would go, you know, you need to go away and have a think, and they wouldn't book you again. So, you know, it's and people wouldn't buy tickets to see you. What most
people think. Does it piss off Stuart Lee that you're so popular with the younger comics?
I don't know. He said when he last came on, he got a bit sort of argy-bargy and unpleasant. Was that he had a couple too many drinks, and he said to me, "I know why you have young comedians on here. It's because you think they'll give you work in other stuff." And I said to him, Stu, you know, I've learned long ago that no one pays you back for anything you do in this business. And it's absolutely true. You know, I don't think any of the people I've ever written for or with, I don't think there's anyone who's gone, "Hey, you did that great thing for me. Come on my TV show." Or, you know,
there might be one little thing that you get, but no one's giving you like a regular thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're not doing it for that. So I think he can't really, you know, he couldn't see that I was, I really love comedy. I'm a big fan of comedy and comedians still make me laugh. I'm not one of those comedians who stands in the back and blah, blah, blah. And increasingly, and I think this show, you know, what's happened, I think, is you're exactly right that it started out as like, oh, you know, why there was a bit of a character of Ed, you know, why is David Mitchell more successful than me? The joke being on myself as well, because obviously there's reasons for that. But it became impossible to carry on with that aspect of the podcast because the podcast was successful enough.
I mean, with Stuart Lee, I mean, you've been good enough to have me on your podcast a couple of times. Like we did one when you came back and it was at the Clapham Grand and stuff. And I was wondering if you did that to piss Stuart Lee off as well, but like the first one of the new series. But like politically, you've never struck me. It's obvious that you have political convictions and, you know, along with many people at the moment, aversion to the government. But you never been one of those people that seems to operate with like really high levels of moral or ideological certainty, you know?
I want someone like you on. You are very, you know, you're very eloquent and your books are great. Your book's great. But you're very eloquent about explaining your point of view. I want to live in a world where, you know, you and I can have a discussion and we can disagree with each other and we probably won't convince of each other of much. But I think I think what's interesting, if you do meet in the middle ground, there's things you've said in the podcast like, "Oh yeah, no, Jeff has a point." Or your book makes me understand why people were voting Tory rather than Labour, right? Why working class people were voting Tory rather than Labour. And a lot of people just go, "Why would you? You'd have to be evil to do that. You'd have to be mad to do that." Yeah. You know, just go and talk to some people and find out why they're doing it. And then you've got a chance of convincing them if the Tories don't just manage to convince them by being so terrible.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I don't like that aspect. Even if it's something I agree with, I don't think it works. It's not a way to convince people. So the people on either side of any of these big debates that get people angry, who then start threatening or start saying, "You're evil for doing this," or "You're wrong for doing this," that's not the way. Even if they are evil, even if their opinion is old fashioned or out of date, the way to convince people is to talk to them and explain, you know, explain why they're wrong, or, you know, or explain why you feel as you feel. I think it's not even about explaining why someone's wrong. And then you know, things do shift. So in the 1970s, most people in the country were racist and sexist. people wouldn't have thought twice. So if a TV, you know, if a pop musician had had sex with a 15-year-old girl, people would have gone, yeah, what, mate? Most people would have gone, well done, mate, that's fine. You know,
I mean, it's easy to forget, even in the 80s, I remember that Bill Wyman story, like, yeah. Oh, Bill, what's he like?
Yeah.
What's he like is a bit noncy, in my view, if you're asking the question.
Things change and people realise, you know, and things move on. And they move in both directions, but I think things are gradually do improve through that kind of barometer of people talking and people realizing they were right, realizing they were wrong. I mean, I would have voted Brexit if I'd known it would destroy the Tory party this effectively. So, you know, I look back with regret that I voted Remain. So I want to talk to people, but I'm more interested in comedy. I'm more interested in good comedians. And yeah, there are people on the right in comedy who I'm not particularly interested in talking to because I don't think they'll be very funny, or I think they're too hardened in their views. But equally, there are people on the left who I would feel the same about, that I don't want just to get someone who's going to be too polemical, or even, you know, I mean, Alexis Sale's been on, and he's, for me, he's politically, I love him as a comedian, politically he's further to the left than I am, and I don't agree with him on everything, but I would still have him on. So, you know, I think
He's further to the left than Jeremy Corbyn, I think it's fair to say.
But, you know, I'd have John Cleese on. I would happily have John Cleese on, and, you know, and talk to him probably mainly about his comedy, but also try to say to him, I don't think what's happened in the world is as bad as in the comedy world is as bad as you think, because we can still.
It's always about lurching to extremes, isn't it? It's you know, the word cancel culture is such a misnomer, because essentially people say it was about consequences. It's true, but then the discussion is about, are the consequences commensurate with the thing? You know, because that doesn't end the argument saying it's just about consequences. It's like, if you have a law that is too punitive, you know, if people are getting sent to prison for having an eighth of cannabis on them, you can say, well, that's just the consequences. Yeah, but like, is that consequence fair?
It's got to fit the, you know, and I think that with everything, I felt that right from the beginning, even like, you know, when in the early days, like football commentators would lose their job for saying a racial epithet, right? Which, you know, someone did one off mic, didn't they? But it was broadcast. And like, he should definitely be reprimanded for that. He should definitely be in trouble. But if he comes back, you know, is that worth losing your whole life? If he came back and said, look, I've looked into it, I'm really sorry about what I've done. You know, it was a stupid mistake. We've all made stupid mistakes, and we've probably all at some point in our lives at that point done something similar in private conversation. You know, is that the end of someone's career? If someone's, you know, Leslie Grantham murdered someone and went to prison and served his time, and then he came back and was an actor. So if that's allowed to happen,
I mean, that is an incredible example there. I mean, no one would ever think that now. What you're alluding to there is like, he served his time.
Yeah.
Now people go, there's no time. This is permanent. You know, you do one really bad thing once and you lose your career forever. That is not fair. And actually, I think the problem with that is I don't think society works like that, because even if you're, whether you call it sort of Anglican or vaguely Christian values or any religion, really, is that forgiveness is sort of built into it. It's kind of really important for all humans to operate on the basis that if you fuck up, you might get another go at it.
I think so. And I think, you know, if you don't give people the chance, I mean, that's the way the penal system works. If you don't give people, I mean, obviously with the extreme things, maybe.
Yeah.
But if you don't give people a second chance, then there's no reason for them to turn around and change their lives. I just think for kids, if you make a mistake, if you genuinely, you know, I don't want people coming going, oh, I'm so sorry, and then they carry on doing it. If someone goes away and thinks about it and is penitent and you know, maybe serves some time, I don't think many people have been, you know, the only person I can really think, there's very few people who've really, really lost out in the long term. So like Jerry Sadovitz got a show cancelled, in return gets a show at the O2, at the Apollo or whatever.
I mean, on that note, actually, I noticed that you were one of the sort of comedians perceived to be of the left that was willing to sort of, no, at least stick your head above the parapet and question, is this where we want to be as an industry? And is that something that you have second thoughts about because of, you know, this idea of what we're all adjacent to? Or in that moment, you know, being a creative person who's passionate about the fringe, was that the more important thing to you?
I think the fringe has to be about artistic freedom and expression. That's why it was set up. And I don't think you can say we're for free speech, but this is too much. Especially if you've A, booked someone, you know what they're like, but B, you haven't written, if the Pleasants had written down somewhere, if anyone gets their penis out or says this word or this word, we're going to cancel their show. Because what if you were in Edinburgh and you're half, you know, I did a show called Hit the Moustache, in which I did say, I wouldn't do it now, but I did within discussing language and stuff, I did say the words. I probably wouldn't do it now. But you know, it was about the nature of language and why we can and can't say them. If halfway through the run, the venue had said, "Oh, sorry, mate, you've said that word, so you're out. You can't do the show again."
Yeah,
I'd have lost that even more than I lost. You know, I would have lost £20,000-£30,000, and there was nobody had said before. And so I don't think you can operate like that, where you're going to,
especially if it was on the basis of one complaint from a front of house 19-year-old called Caleb.
I understand why they, you know, I understand that probably the staff said, we don't want to staff it. But if they'd said, all right, look, we'll find some staff who will staff. He was only doing one more show. It was absolutely pathetic.
I know.
You know, so like I would have kind of staffed it because I love Jerry. He offends me. He makes me feel sick. But he says stuff that is absolutely beyond the pale. But that is the character. He's the lowest of the low.
Yeah.
And he's punching up at everyone. If he started saying, oh, well, I won't do anything about this subject or that subject, that would be offensive because it would be saying, I don't think this, you know, this is a special case in which I'm not allowed to be the most offensive. That's what his act is. Like it or not, that's fine. It's, you know, I've been to it and thought, it's like a theatrical experience. It's like going to see, if you went to see Macbeth and said, oh, fucking hell, some children get murdered in this play, we have to stop this play. You go, no,
Richard, though, I bet you any money is that there are certain productions that are now giving that trigger warning.
Well,
and go, oh, by the way, the wife is a bit pushy. So if pushy wives upset you, then just be aware.
But it comes from a place of people thinking if you're joking about something or you're not taking it seriously. And it comes, you know, and it comes from people who want to say, and you know, I'm as you say, I'm left wing, and I don't want people to be shouting those words about, and there's reasons they shouldn't shout them about. But it comes from people having a list and not being able to have any kind of understanding of context.
Okay, I hope you're enjoying the chat with Richard there. We've got a couple more new patrons to welcome. Stuart Hilton. I mean, we spoke last week about surnames, that when your daughter brings home a fella, you're going to be happy with that, ain't you? Stuart Hilton. You're dating Stuart Hilton? The Hiltons? Oh, we're having the Hiltons over. Maybe it'd be like those aspirational friends. Did I mention that the other week about when your mum and dad have aspirational friends? Do you remember that when you were growing up, when you saw a different side to your parents? When they're, oh, we're having the Hiltons over tonight. Mum's fucking got out her best cutlery, right? Do you remember that? Is that a phenomenon worth exploring when you actually see your parents transparent aspirational social climbing? But the Hiltons are over, and then there's James Tucker. James Tucker's the opposite. Tucker's one of those names. Maybe it's just because I was bullied by a kid called Tucker. But James Tucker, I mean, that is a name that strike fear. It just, James Tucker sounds like your straight up hardest kid in the year. Do you know the kid that was always called throwing chairs at teachers? And then like the day you found out he was permanently excluded in the early spring of the year you were doing GCSEs, it was like fucking ding dong, the witch is dead. Do you know what I mean? No more ginchins. James Tucker's been expelled. This is just a quick hype. To remind you that Jeff Random, the show I did on Radio 4, if you can't be asked to do the BBC Sounds thing or get that app, just go to iTunes and go to Comedy of the Week, because Radio 4 have made that show the Comedy of the Week. Download it, and just wherever you can, give it good feedback. We're pitching for a series of this. It's the best feedback I've ever had from a show that I've done, so we really want to make this go the difference, and obviously numbers do matter. A reminder, a Late Night Mash podcast I'm doing with Olga Koch is still, I think there's a couple more episodes of that to come. And that anybody in the Patreon community, that there will be shows next year. I think it's on Wednesday, the 25th of January in London. I think it's the first Thursday in March in Leeds. So there will be details about that to come. Okay, let's get back to chatting bollocks with Richard Herring. You talk about, you know, the cancer, and you sort of seem to become quite goal orientated, which was sound like a really positive thing. You lost weight and stuff, and it became really important to you to sort of honour this book in that you had doing Taskmaster, Champion of Champions. And you, there is this interesting, I mean, Taskmaster is probably between a quiz thing and a panel show, but you, like me, have done a lot of TV quizzing now. It's a new circuit, isn't it? I mean, it's this really cool thing that's cropped up in the last 5 years.
Well, I really, you know, I've always been a fan of watching those quiz shows. I mean, Taskmasters is a bit different, but I think it's the great, I think it's the best show on TV. because it's just, and you know, it allows people to be funny within their own rights, but also it's, you know, it's up beyond your control as well. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the idea of being able to, watching Mastermind as a kid and thinking one day I'll be able to go on that because or anything, or Pointless or whatever, it is kind of nuts that, you know, I think it's sad that that's the main way a comedian can get on TV these days. But as a fan of quiz shows, it's so much fun to do, you know, something like, I really love The Chase. Have you done The Chase? That's such a
no. I mean, this is the funny thing now between comics. You're like, you know, it used to be, have you done the Bearcat gig in here, or have you done 8 out of 10 cats? You know, have you done? Oh, who books it? Bradley books it. I'll put in a word for you, Bradley. No, I haven't done that.
It's such a good format because it's terrifying, and you can do really well and come away with nothing. You've got to work as a team, and it's such a clever an exciting format, and genuinely, you know, I just was terrified about the choices, choosing whether I was going to go for the high amount or the low, you know, the lower amount and all that sort of stuff.
How frustrating are the inadequacies of your teammates in a situation like that? Because obviously on Pointless, there's just two of you and that's an issue. When there's three other people, did it get frustrating?
It did a little bit within the... I mean, it looked like everyone was going to get knocked out. And, you know, Kay Burley kind of made some basic error. They put a couple in that I think they think you're going to be able to get. But, you know, she did, because she made a couple of political ones she got wrong. And she looked like she was going to get knocked out. I thought it was going to just be me. And, yeah, in the final chase, there was a female footballer on. And she would, they'd obviously directed a lot of sports questions. And she would buzz in and just not have listened to the question. And I would have known the answer. They were easy ones, like, you know, what continent is karate from, or something like that, okay? Yeah. And I just thought, well, I'll leave it. That's obviously hers, I'll leave it. But she said Japan or whatever. You know, she said the country rather than the continent. And so she made, you know, so yeah, you kind of go, every second counts. But it was so lovely. And we did, you know, everyone did well enough, apart from Tim Lovejoy got knocked off. That was the end.
I mean, it's funny when you talk about, like, kind of the jeopardy of it, and Kay Burley getting politics questions wrong. When I did Mastermind, Levi Roots was on, and he's the guy that invented reggae sauce. And so he picked as his subject, which I thought was madness, he picked British reggae, reggae in the late 80s or something like that.
Right, okay.
I thought, do not, because that's your fucking brand, man. And so, like, as you say, they often give you a couple of half follies straight out of the gate, and he got those, and then he got one wrong, and I thought, I know that, and I'm pretty white, you know, whitest of the white. It was a question. I think the answer was Eddie Grant, and then you just saw the thing descend on him, and the sweat start going, because he suddenly thinks seeing a stock share price going down. I mean that is the thing. Is on the one hand, there's not the immediate pressure of a panel show to be funny the whole time you're there, but then there's this also jeopardy of looking like a fucking idiot.
Yeah, I've nearly cried twice. I've done Pointless 4 times, and I basically felt my voice going, because I'm so, you know, I know I'm not going to do it, or I'm scared of getting knocked out. And it meant so, but the first time when it meant so much to me, and I was so nervous. And then it was on with Rona Cameron, and she didn't listen to the question. And you know, it was about 80s music. It was at, you know, we were getting, there was like a couple of, like, someone like Barry Cryer and someone on, you know, some old guys who wouldn't know. And, you know, and we were deaf, and you'd look at that and go, oh, Rich and Rona are going to be okay in this.
And then
she messed up. And then I was just like, my mind was kind of racing, and I came up with some answers. Thought, oh, no, because it was like number one, solo artist, number ones in the 80s. And then you think, was that the 1980s? Was that solo? Was that number one? You know, and then you get into this spot. And then I had to get under 7. And so I was thinking, it's got to be really obscure. So I'm going to take a chance that Brian Ferry released Jealous Guy under his own name rather than Roxy Music. And then, so I, you know, we are out straight away from this thing. But I was absolutely, I nearly cried, because it was such a, you know, without...
I mean, again, this is another thing that men aren't supposed to laugh at, but men crying is still funny to me. And if someone had kicked you in the bollocks at that point.
I mean, it's sort of so weird. But Rich, I was interviewing Richard Osman at the weekend, and he always says, I'm the worst ever contestant on Pointless, which isn't fair. Every time I put it, we did finally win it. With Les Dennis when I went on the fourth time. That's sort of law of averages. But every time, I've always been like jinxed by the person I've been on. Although I was on with my wife, and we were a bit unlucky, and she did quite well. I told her just kick it. I just said, kick it in, just make sure it's right. And she basically family fortune Pointless and got the highest possible answer for everything, and then I had to come in under the radar with something like. But it nearly worked that time.
Yeah, you knock it long to the big lad. And obviously, you know, one of the things with these things is they're good at. Let's be honest, you know, profile. They get like a lot. Most of them get much bigger audiences than a comedy format. And you know, when you talk about your treatment and stuff, you mentioned a few times. People recognising who you were. And I just found that interesting because obviously, you know, there's good fame and there's bad fame. How did it feel to be in such an exposed situation? And people were going, no, I'll get it in a minute. You were, oh, I know you.
It wasn't so bad. But I'll tell you when I thought I had a, like a sexually transmitted disease in the like the early noughties after I'd just been on TV and you have to go to the clinic and sit in amongst people, you kind of think, oh God, this, if someone recognises me here, this is embarrassing. But it kind of, I think I was sort of more overwhelmed. And in fact, my oncologist who claimed, he said, oh yes, you're on Taskmaster and blah, 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 you know, he just Googled me before. Someone had obviously told him I was Taskmaster. And I did talk to him and he did admit, I knew he hadn't really recognized me. It was weird waking up from the general anesthetic.
Yeah.
It was like a semi-circ, and you're woozy. And like, sometimes people are just hallucinating and talking shit at that point, and you've got morphine and you're off your face a bit. And so there was a group of people almost asking me to do jokes and stuff, you know, going, oh, really? we've all come to see your knob
as well. Like, there's, you go throughout a lifetime, I mean, how you're now in your mid-50s and obviously there's a group of people that you haven't had sexual congress with that have all seen your knob. I mean, that is, and you go, they must talk about it. Once they've seen a famous person's knob, they must go, they must really, you're only human, right?
Between themselves, maybe they might do that. But yeah, it was like people had come from different parts of the hospital to see me. But I do have this kind of weird, you know, it's always been, even when we were on TV, it was always like one person would recognise us and the eight people they were with wouldn't know who the fuck they were. And then they get angry. The person who knew you would get angry with me for not being more famous. Go, yeah, I'm talking to my friend, you're famous, they don't know who you are. And so I feel very fortunate to be, and this is the nice thing about the podcast as well, it's this middle ground where if anyone does recognise me, occasionally people are listening to the podcast when they see me, and that must blow your fucking mind, mustn't it, if you walk down the street.
Yeah, I've had that a couple of times. It is really, and I can totally understand why that is, where they go, dude, like they just magicked you into existence through their phone.
But mostly, you know, I can live my life. I can, you know, I just sort of think, I would have loved to have been famous when I was 20, you know, like properly famous. Mm. When I was in my 20s, but it would, you know, and been invited to all the parties and married a supermodel and all that sort of, just had sex with a supermodel, all that sort of thing. But, you know, I'm so glad. It would have destroyed me, I think, if I'd certainly got into drugs and stuff. I think I was too, I didn't, but it would have been too much for me. And I think I would have turned a gigantic arsehole and destroyed everything. And I'd probably be dead, I think, to be honest. But I think having this level where, you know, you get a little bump up occasionally, and you get some people saying once a week or twice a week, someone goes, I really think you're brilliant. You know, that's a nice little booster. Yeah, yeah. Whereas if you're Frank Skinner or, you know, whoever's the big, big comedian at the moment, when you're with Frank, walking down the street with Frank in Edinburgh, which is even in Edinburgh, I'm like, it's a bit hard to walk down the street in Edinburgh for me. If you walk down the street with Frank, it's just every fucking person knows who you are. So guys are shouting at vans, and you've got to be, you know, however you're feeling, whatever you're going through, you've got to be, if you're Frank Skinner, you've got to be Frank Skinner. And he's great at it, and he does it. But if you don't want that, then that's a difficult thing to cope with. So I feel lucky, you know, now I've got kids. But, you know, imagine going to the soft play and then you're the centre of attention at the soft play. You know what I mean? It would be, imagine being, I always think of if you were Mr. Tumble, and had kids, I don't know if he has got kids, he could never take his kids anywhere, can he? Because even though kids don't think Mr. Tumble's the same person, he's still Justin, so he'd have to disguise himself. You know, so I think you realise as you get older, it's the same thing as with the podcast. I've sort of realised how absolutely, I've sort of found a sweet spot accidentally that I wouldn't have aimed for, where I can do this job, I can make money from it, and I think I could probably work for forever unless I get cancelled. You know, enough people like me, but it's not going to destroy my life. I've realized that's the absolute great point to be, not to be super famous, but, and then things go up and down, you know.
And I think that does come through in the book. Like, there's a philosophical thing that comes through, you know, the experience of what you went through. And in a way, I've avoided the sort of chronology of what happened with you, because I think, you know, that kind of ups and downs of it is a big part of the book. And it's a really interesting pattern to, you know, go from the anxiety over appointments, the results and stuff like that. But it does, you know, there's a positive thing that comes out the other side of that. It's just basic gratitude. You know, it's a simple thing, but it really is an important part. I mean, I know that I understand why religion isn't a part of people's lives, but I bet you any money that bit where people went to church and went, yeah, cheers, that bit was really fucking good for us, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it is to realize, you know, the whole COVID thing should have made people realize that, you know, we need to work together, because even if you're rich and you can afford private medicine, if there's a pandemic, you need everyone to be well, because you'll all be fucked if everyone gets it. So having private medicine can't help you. And, you know, we should be so much more grateful. The things that the NHS went through in those couple of years is insane. So it's insane, you know, and to be then there for something completely different and them still managing to see you and get everything done. I was so impressed by it. But yeah, I mean, look, it made me, even though, like, you know, as a comedian, when I thought it might be something, there was still a part of my brain going, this is great, you know, we can do this, can do that. The minute I found the actual diagnosis, I wasn't thinking about comedy. I was thinking about my being alive and being alive for my kids. And I was thinking about my family. I completely realized, not that I didn't know before, but it completely brought home, you know, how short life is, how, you know, how life can just go bang like that. You know, you can go. But also how lucky we are to be and how lucky we are to have these relationships. So, you know, I knew it was absolutely like, obviously one big negative and a couple of shaky moments, but nearly everything in this was so positive. You know, life is such an unlikely thing to happen to anyone. We are so lucky to be here at all, whatever our circumstances, really.
I mean, it's an interesting philosophical point to end, because there was a point of me, right, this is the comic's dilemma, where I wanted to ask you about this anecdote where your son ends up shitting on your mum's patio.
Yeah.
But then I'm also aware that comedy sometimes, you know, at the end of Blackadder Goes Forth, where they go over the top there.
Yeah.
And sometimes comedy can come to a point at the end where there's just this little sweet spot. So I'm going to, for once, veer on the side, rather than something about shit or the body. I'm going to sort of like bring it to a close on a really nice note. And I just recommend everybody to check out the book, because, like, obviously there's this story about your journey with testicular cancer, but there is so much more in there about comedy and your worldview and stuff like that. And just remind us when the book is out and the title.
It's out on the 20th of October. It's called Can I Have My Ball Back? There's an audio book of it, which I did myself with a few extras as well. But you can get it basically from any bookshop or wherever you get your books or audio books from.
Ram, Richard Herring, thanks so much for appearing on What Most People Think.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me, mate. Nice to see you.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that chat as much as I did. It's just such a nice guy, Richard, and funny and easy to talk to. And I always find guys, you know, similar with when we had David Baddiel and Al Murray on the show, is people that have been around and, you know, had high profiles for a long time, but you just still get the impression that they like comedy and that they like young comics. I was gonna say they like young comedians, that sounds dodgy in this day and age, but you know, they've still got the passion for it. So in any way that you can support it, I mean, obviously buying the book, I recommend fully to go to a live record of Rochelle Estepa, because it gets into some dark and very funny places, you know, and there's a reason why it's been such a successful podcast for so long. That really is all from me this week. I mean, God knows what will happen in the next, I mean, look, Liz Truss could go in. I will promise this. If the Prime Minister goes, I'll do a bonus episode. But I hope you have a fantastic week. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to this show. Please do recommend it to your friends. And I will see you next week on What Most People Think.